Well, here we are again. It's the third Sunday after Epiphany, and our intent for the day is, and indeed the week, is sincerity and control of speech. And as usual, what I'm going to do is go through the readings of the day to some extent and show how they fit in with the with the intent of the day. Now, and also I want to just set the tone with the prayer for the day. So, if you'll join me in prayer. O Lord, who didst unsparingly rebuke injustice and hypocrisy, we pray that we may be just and true of heart in all our dealings with ourselves and with our brethren, that we may live openly and without guile before thee. O great King of righteousness, to whom be praise for ever and ever. Amen. So, now, the epistle is relatively self-explanatory because it's all about control of speech, as you will soon see. So I'm going to just read it out, and it's from the book of Ecclesiasticus, the 19th chapter, and we're going to begin at the 6th verse. So, and I don't know if you know about Ecclesiasticus, but it's the instructions of the churches, or to the churches. Okay, right. An ecclesia is a church. So. Right. He that can rule his tongue shall live without strife. Sort of makes sense. He that hateth babbling shall have less evil. Rehearse not unto another that which is told unto thee, and thou shalt fare never the worse. No, don't tell tales. Don't tell stories. Whether it be to friend or foe, talk not of other men's lives. Sort of breaking all the rules of modern day reporting and modern day journalism. Just goes to show that what modern day journalists are really all about is something a little bit different from maybe what they should be about. And if thou canst without offence, reveal them not, other men's lives, that is. If thou hast heard a word, let it die with thee. Admonish a friend, it may be he hath not done it. And if he hath done it, that he do it no more. Admonish thy friend, it may be that he hath not said it. And if he have, that he speak it not again. Admonish a friend, for many times it is a slander. And believe not every tale. There is one that slippeth in his speech, but not from his heart. And who is he that hath not offended with his tongue? The knowledge of the commandments of the Lord is the doctrine of life. And they that do things that please him shall receive the fruit of the tree of immortality. For to know him is perfect righteousness, yea, to know his power is the root of immortality. So, that's pretty good advice, actually. And it's all about not spreading things, because there's a good chance that many things that get spread are not true. Or if they are true, they're not true quite in the way that they've been spread. That happens a lot. It doesn't mean that, you know, if there need be justice, that it should be meted out at some point. But you have to be very careful yourself in how you go about enjoining yourself to what you think is true. You better make sure that it's true, and there's the right way to go about doing it, and that is secretly. If you look at the way that people pursued justice in the correct manner, it's always done secretly. It's not done with a big flurry. It's not done with a big hoo-ha. It's done in a way where justice can be served, and it can be served in an impartial manner. As soon as you make a big hoo-ha about things, you no longer have the potential to administer justice in an impartial manner. And this can lead to all sorts of things happening that are the wrong things and things that you wouldn't want to have happen in the first place. So it's always wise, if you hear something, to not talk about it. Maybe you go and check it out yourself, and maybe you deal with it yourself, and maybe you confront a person yourself. But if you are to do so, you must be sure of your facts first. You must be sure of yourself and not merely acting on what you believe to be true or what you are upset is true. A lot of the time people spread all kinds of things that are not true because they are afraid that they're true. And fear is the thing that's really doing the talking there. A lot of the time this happens. So if you allow fear to be doing the talking, then aren't you really just spreading fear? That happens a lot. It's happened recently. It's happened really over the last 2 years. On every side, huge amounts of fear have been spread, and they have done humanity no good whatsoever. But they've made a small number of people very rich, and a small number of people more powerful than they have any right to be, including some people in our own officialdom, some people that ought not to be, have been enabled to be much more rich than they should be. And they've done it on the backs of other people's fear and other people's misery. So be careful what you spread. Right, moving on. The gospel. So, the Holy Gospel, this is one from St. Matthew, and it begins in the 23rd chapter, and wouldn't you know it, the 23rd verse. So I love this one because it's telling us something about ourselves. Now, that Ecclesiasticus thing is beautiful, right? All that stuff about the knowledge of the commandments of the Lord is the doctrine of life. What are the commandments of the Lord? Does anybody know? Does anybody know what the commandments of the Lord are? Because they are important for this, for the gospel. They're important. So let's have a think and go into the gospel. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides, who strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Remind you of anybody that you know now? Ye make clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. Right, well, I don't know if there's more to this. Obviously, there's quite a bit more that I've got to read. But I just want to mention that this, I believe, is incredibly relevant to our world today, because we have lots of people posturing, and they are indeed blind and rather incompetent guides of the rest of us. We have a whole bunch of people posing at being good right now. In fact, if I was to look at this century and I was to compare it with the first century, I would say that this century has a lot in common with the first century. I would say that the first century Roman Empire has an awful lot in common with the world as we understand it now. And I don't know whether I've ever explained this before, but when Revelation talks about coming out of Babylon, the person who wrote that was using Babylon not as code necessarily just for Rome, but as code for a system. code for a system that leads to the very same hypocrisy that Jesus is talking about here. Anyway, let me go on. Well, Matthew was talking about here, if you want to think of it as being Matthew. But anyway, it's the voice of Jesus speaking. Cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. So what is the cup and the platter? Well, obviously it's a metaphor, but what's he referring to when he talks about this cup and this platter? What could it be? What is in cups and platters, and that is so important that it be clean? It's kind of important for us to know that. I will come back to it, but ye are like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but within are full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. As I'm sure you can imagine, gravesites are graves and so on. A sepulchre, of course, is a place where people's bones are kept after they die. And in fact, the bones are sort of, the bodies are kept actually, and the bodies gradually, the bodies gradually decay away to just the bones. And so the uncleanness is that decay, that corruption of the dead body. And of course, you know, all sorts of things live on those dead bodies as well. So, you know, pretty nasty little things. Even so, ye outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within ye are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. He doesn't pull any punches. And he said unto his disciples, do ye not after their works, for they say and do not. All their works they do for to be seen of men. But whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. So this is Jesus telling you to do things in secret, to do things secretly, to not posture, but actually to do the secret things. Now, I've discussed in previous talks all about the secret things, and I've basically mentioned that doing the secret things is something to do with letting go of the things in the world that disturb you and finding out what it is that is within you that is causing you to be disturbed by the things of the world. See, the world, in all of its variation, the things that we would call both good and bad about the world, they're all fine. The world works properly. The world works exactly as it is supposed to. What doesn't work is our response to it. So when we are faced with difficulties and faced with problems, that's something that we really do need to consider. How is our response to the world? How is our response to the world leading us into whatever the state is that we don't like? Now, it may be that there is really something wrong with the world. I'm not saying that there's not things wrong with the world right now, because there are. But what is the correct response to the things that are wrong in the world? Is it to get upset about the things that are wrong in the world? Is that the correct response? Is it to posture and pretend that you are leading everybody through the difficulties and in fact you are completely incompetent and you're not leading them anywhere except to your demise and their demise all at the same time? Our politicians, I'm afraid, at every level, state and federal, our politicians are very much those incompetent people. Oh, when I say politicians, I don't just mean the people who are in the parliament. I also mean all of the apparatchiks that are inside of the parties and all of the people that operate inside of the public service at a political level. They are all politicians, especially the ones in the health department. Now, moving on, because I don't want to get bogged down in that stuff. Let's come back to this idea of what is the cup and the platter? What is Jesus really talking about? Okay. So it's pretty straightforward. You know, from a certain perspective, you can think of, well, you know, you're gonna eat out of a cup and you're gonna eat out of a platter, right? Now you can think of it as the Holy Grail if you want. I mean, that's okay too. It's okay to think of it as the Holy Grail. But if you think that you've sorted everything out by cleaning the outside of the cup, and then you try to, or the platter, and then you try to eat from the inside of it, and it's actually full of all sorts of nastiness, you're just going to make yourself sick, aren't you? So that's what people do. People, so how is that done? Well, in the old days, when Jesus was around, he was referring to the Jewish practices, which were very much about, very similar actually to a lot of Hindu practices and a bunch of other people who have got very specific things that they do at any given moment. You know, they follow this practice on this day and that practice on that day, and they do all these different things. They have all these different obligations, all these different practices they have to do. And so long as they fulfill all of those obligations, then they're fine. You know, they're doing God's work as far as they're concerned. And that's the Orthodox Judaism way. And it's much of what the Vedas are about. I don't know if you've ever read the Vedas, but they're mostly about a whole bunch of practices that that you have to fulfill. And you know, there's even things like, you know, certain formulaic prayers that you say to Indra or Shiva or, you know, whoever it is that you need to say your oblation, you know, give your oblations to, and these sorts of things. So you've got to think. Religion tends to end up becoming about following laws in minutia, not about the spirit of the law that is supposed to be behind them. And so a lot of the time, what happens is people get wound up in technicalities. Now, this is human nature. It's not the religion's fault that it goes like this. It's human beings do this to religion over time. Christianity, the first impulse of Christianity, is quite a different thing from what we ended up having as Christianity by, you know, 1,000 to, you know, well, where we are now, say, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 years later, right? And, you know, let's say that Christianity is 2,000 years old. We don't know whether it's 2,000 years old, or it might be older, or it might be younger, but let's just say it's 2,000 years old. Then once we got out to about 1500, the Christianity of 1500 was quite a different kind of Christianity from the Christianity of the first century, or the second century, or the third century. It's only really where you start to get formulas being applied in the fourth century, with the lead up to Nicaea and so on, and you know, Emperor Constantine threatening to chop people's heads off if they don't come to an agreement. And then everybody coming to some formulaic agreement, which leads to the, you know, I mean, first of all, there was the Apostles' Creed, and then there was the Nicene Creed and the Constantinople Nicene Creed, which are all pretty much, I mean, you can believe them if you want, but they're creeds that were designed by committee. That there's not one ounce of divine inspiration in them at all. They don't come from the original Christian teachings at all. They just don't. Even though, you know, there's a claim in the Apostles' Creed that it's from the Apostles by calling it the Apostles' Creed, it's got really nothing to do with the Apostles. The people who, by the time they were doing the Apostles' Creed, those people were calling themselves apostles, but They were a far cry from the apostles of the first and second century, you know, early second century. A very different religion by the time you get out to the fourth century. So now let's move on though, because we want to really look at how do you clean the cup on the inside. It's all very well for me to say this stuff. And this brings me to this idea of knowledge of the commandments of the Lord is the doctrine of life. And they that do things that please him shall receive the fruit of the tree of immortality. So, if like Abel, who please the Lord by sacrificing the right sorts of things. And Cain did not sacrifice the right sort of things. Because every time I read that those words, please the Lord, I think to myself of Abel versus Cain. It's just something about the way that that's written. But there's lots of people that have pleased the Lord. Solomon pleased the Lord, did he not? Solomon pleased the Lord a great deal in the Old Testament. Who else pleased the Lord? Many different people pleased the Lord. And how did they do it? How did they please the Lord? Were they interested in the things... what were they interested in that they pleased the Lord? Now, obviously, in Abel's case, Abel was a shepherd. He slaughtered a sheep for the Lord. It makes the Lord sound pretty bloodthirsty. But that's not really what it's about. It's not really talking about slaughtering a sheep, or, you know, slaughtering the first lamb or whatever. You've got to think of these things as a metaphor. You've got to think of these ideas as the lamb is the lamb that Abel slaughtered for the Lord and pleased him with it. It's the authors of Genesis. It's Moses, if you want to say that it was Moses that wrote it. If it's Moses' way of saying, although we think probably it's very old, this particular text, it's his way of saying that you're giving the best of what you've got, and the best of what you've got has got to be of a certain status, because Cain also gave the best of what he got. He gave the Lord grains and these sort of things, and they didn't please the Lord. The Lord couldn't do much with the grasses, but he could do something with the slain lamb. So now, what's that really saying? Is that saying that the Lord wants you to, you know, go out and kill for him and give him fresh meat? I don't think so. I think it's a way of saying that if you produce anything that is going to give value to the universe, then that value shall be returned to you. And that's how you please the Lord. You know that you've pleased the Lord because you've given something of value and that value is returned to you. So if you do something that's valuable, that helps other people, that helps people in general, then or helps the world in general, allows the world to become better through yourself. This is where the idea of good works comes from. It's not so much about following formulaic laws about, oh, you know, you've got to, you know, you've got, you know, observe the Sabbath. And I'm not saying those things aren't important, but the purpose of observing the Sabbath and following all these rules is to put you in the right state. It's a ritual to put you in the right state so that you can be pleasing to the Lord. It's not that you follow the formulas like a mechanical person, that like a robot that just goes through the motions. The idea is that you do something that's really going to involve sacrifice, that really involves you making yourself holy. So you give something that is of great worth in your sacrifice. Now, in the case of a Christian, no, you're not supposed to go out and slaughter a lamb. The idea of cleaning the inside of the cup and the inside of the bowl or the inside of the platter is the idea of going within yourself and cleaning yourself up. Going within and discovering that which ails you. If there's something that ails you out there in the universe, there's something that ails you within yourself. And if you're going to do it, then it's not a matter of, and this, you know, this is the same as car, you know, pulling out the beam that's in your own eye before you go after the speck that's in your brother's. So it's not just about what you're going to do with the the beam in your own eye, or it's how do you do it? And the instructions have been given. Follow the commandments of the Lord. What are the commandments of the Lord? Well, you could say it's the Ten Commandments. But really, the Ten Commandments boil down to the two commandments, the two love commandments. They always boil down to the two love commandments, the one from Deuteronomy and the one from Leviticus. Deuteronomy, love the Lord thy God, love the one God with all thy heart, mind, and strength, and love thy neighbor as thyself, from Leviticus. The two love commandments are the underpinnings. They're the underpinnings of all of the law. And they really are. If you follow those and you follow them faithfully, which is what faith means, it means following those two commandments faithfully, then won't you naturally keep your tongue quiet? Won't you naturally, because you're in a space of love, won't you naturally look at people in a different way from the way that you normally do in normal functioning? When we normally look at other people, it's our mind chitter-chattering away, and it's talking away about other people, even before we've opened our mouths. But the mind is not you. The mind chitter-chattering away, it's not you. After all, did you come up with language? Did you invent all those words? Did you invent all those turns of phrase that you use habitually without thinking about them? You didn't. Language isn't even you. The things that you say aren't you. If you're going to be you, it's being in a space of love. And it's a very different thing from criticizing and judging and evaluating other people on the basis of the things that you think you know that you've got going on in your head. Well, you think it's your head, but you know, you've got all those things that you've got going on, all those statements about other people that you've got going on. We all have going on about other people. When you move to the world of love, when you move to the world of the heart, you don't have any of those things going on. And so the point of moving towards and tasting the fruit of immortality, tasting the fruit of life, the fruit of the tree of life, tasting the fruits of the tree of life comes from emptying out the inside of you. That doesn't mean you tell everybody about what's going on inside of you. That's not how you empty out what's inside of you. All you do is add to the mess on the outside, the mishigos that's all around us. So you don't do that. How do you empty out the inside? How do you clean out the inside of you? How do you clean that which is within? You clean that which is within by going into and making all of your behaviors and actions as close to, and it's not easy to do this, obviously, as close to the love commandments as you can. Now, a little trick. Here's the way I have done it when I've been successful at this. And I haven't been that successful, but I have from time to time. Instead of attempting to love God when you don't even know who or what God is, and attempting to love your neighbor as yourself when you don't really feel that way and you don't really know who your neighbor is and you don't really, you know, instead of doing it that way, instead of sort of attempting to force yourself into it or attempting to affect the pose of being loving, which is something that you get a lot of the time, people affect the pose because it's that whole fake it till you make it idea. And pretend to do it, you know, you can pretend anything and master it. Well, yes and no. You can, but there's always a trick. So instead of doing it that way, where you're attempting to fake it till you make it, affect a pose, or force yourself into something, here's what I do, or here's what I have done that has been successful for me. I asked myself the question, since I didn't know who or what God was, and here's this book asking me to love the Lord, the one God, with all my heart, mind, and strength. I asked myself, why should I? Now, that may sound a bit silly to say that, because, you know, one ought to be grateful, right? But what I discovered was not, you know, I asked it in an open way. I didn't ask it as a, well, why should I? Why should I do that? I said, well, you know, why should I love this being or this entity that I'm calling God that has this quality of being? And really, that's the same question as asking, who is God? What is God? Who is God? So it's really, when you ask that, when you try to do this thing, what you're really doing, when you're really loving God, you can't love a one you do not know. You can only love that which you know. So given that you've been asked to love God, that must mean that you need to know God first. So in order to love God, you first of all ask the question, God is what? Who? In other words, you inquire into the nature of God. And as you inquire into the nature of God, deeper and deeper and deeper, you'll discover that you quite naturally end up loving God. Because you'll begin to see all the things, first of all, you'll begin to see all the things that you have to be grateful for. But also, at a certain point, you cross a certain kind of threshold where you have an understanding both of love and of the capacities that love gives you and powers that love gives you. And you may even get to have an experience of God, a direct experience of God. And then you know very well who you are loving. And usually the experience, this kind of experience, is an experience of love, of God's love for you. And it's quite something when you have it. It's really quite something. And it's the main reason I came back to this church. Even though I came back to the church many, many years after having the experience, it took me a very long time to understand what the experience was. Even though I appreciated it at the time as being an experience of love, I did not realize it was such an, I did not realize it was a truly Christian experience. I did not realize the fundamental Christian nature of the experience, nor did I realize the fundamental nature of my Christianity. So the reason I am a priest is because of this experience that I had, direct experience of God and of God's love for me. Okay, now, when you inquire into these things, you naturally discover that you end up following the second commandment as an adjunct or a fallout of the first, a sort of lemma or a sort of something that follows straight on from the previous commandment. As soon as you're loving God, you discover that loving your neighbor is part of loving God. And loving your enemy is part of loving your neighbor. So they go down in sort of steps. You can see that, perhaps. Now, the hypocrites, the Jewish hypocrites, they didn't do that. They weren't about loving anybody, frankly. They were about following a bunch of rules. And the result of that was to strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. In other words, getting the proportions profoundly wrong. Straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel means that they sweat the small stuff, you know. They make mountains out of molehills, as it were. It's the same idea. And you'll see that there are lots of people that are doing that in our world right now. Lots of very hypocritical, very incompetent, and extremely stupid and misguided people who are, unfortunately, the blind leading the stupid. Officials in our world today who just keep on lying to us over and over again, hoping that the lies will eventually stick. And thank goodness for those of us that can see it. Thank goodness for those of us who can see that these people are lying, because now that the truth is finally starting to come out about all of the lies that they've told over the last 2 years, it's going to enable us, as things really come to a head, to be able to bring these people to justice and have justice be done. So, I'm not saying we're at the beginning. We're nowhere near to the point where we're going to be able to have justice be meted out in the right sort of way. There are many bridges left to cross, but we're on our way, because some very smart and courageous people have already done in other parts of the world most of the lion's share of the work for us. And now all we have to do is take up the splendid torch that they have left for us and move forward with it. So, with that said, I suggest that we all spend a bit of time going within and cleaning our own cup and platter, and doing that by asking ourselves, not just what is it to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, and strength, but who is the one we love? Thank you for your attention.